It was eloquent. It was thought-provoking. And much of it I agree with. And some of it, obviously, I would add clarifications. And so the question is how to best use our time. Can I just put my bottom line up front and maybe go through my own framework for looking at these things? And don't hold me to an exact agreement with what Professor Mann has said, but in part there's some overlap in it. My bottom line up front is that you're going to see a slow and steady move by President Obama away from the Bush administration method of operation. But it's going to be punctuated by the pressure of events at the time. And so much as many in this audience, some of whom supported me in my run a few years ago, and I'm very grateful for that support, but much as you would like a complete renunciation of the Bush years, it's unlikely to happen exactly like that. But why? And what can you do about it? Well, let me digress for a couple of minutes, and in a much more extemporaneous and less elegant presentation than you just heard, let me see if I can explain why I draw this conclusion. First of all, I totally agree that we have seen the decline of interstate war. It's a remarkable thing. From World War II, where we had major industrial powers involved, we ended up in a period of sort of one-sided proxy wars, with the United States and its major allies fighting against proxies of the Soviet Union in Korea, in Indochina, in Vietnam. And then we ended up with lesser proxy wars in Africa, where the Soviets brought in the Cubans, in the Middle East, where the Soviets manipulated the South Yemenis, in Central America, where the Soviets used a Cuban support base to foment disturbances in Central America. And then there was the collapse of the Soviet Union. It simply failed, and as Mike indicated, it wasn't really because of Ronald Reagan. But there is a certain mythology, and we are struggling with the strength of that mythology. In fact, when the Cold War was over, it was clear that the likelihood of major interstate war had declined precipitously. I remember in 1994, late 94, a Chinese general came to the Pentagon and presented us his briefing. China had just done an analysis and said that there would be no wars between states. All future wars were likely to be between states. Of course, Taiwan was part of China. Therefore, that didn't exclude military action against Taiwan, should it become necessary to do so, but rather to say that there was no reason for a system of alliances which was designed to protect and secure one state against the invasion of another. And they were almost right. Almost, but not quite. Because what the United States had discovered with the end of the Cold War was, as Paul Wolfowitz put it to me in the Pentagon in 1991, there was now nothing to stop us from using our military strength to roll up these old Soviet proxy states in the Middle East. We just handled Noriega in Panama. It was done well. And if you've never heard the 82nd Airborne Chorus sing about how da 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 they moved into Panama and they got rid of Noriega and set to a beat, and these guys are up there in their battle dress uniforms and talking about it and bragging about it, it was quite amazing. One of my mentors in the Army, General Maxwell Thurman, was the commander at the time, and it was he who picked the song that was bombarding the papal nuncio in Panama City. I fought the law, and the law won. And Noriega eventually came out and surrendered. They said it couldn't be done, but in 3 weeks it was done. And the United States had successfully used military force. I was a captain sitting at Brown University in 1974 in uniform with four cadets. It was a Brown University conference on civil military relations, and Les Aspin was a Rhodes Scholar congressman from the House Armed Services Committee, who many of you may remember as a bright leading light in the Democratic Party. And he looked down at the stage, and of course, here's all these hirsute, bedraggled Brown students and from all over, and it was nasty and grubby. And when we pulled up there, a cab driver rolled down his snow-encrusted window and said, "Uniforms! 1974! I haven't seen you guys on campus in 5 years! Welcome back!" So, you know, we were expecting to be welcomed. And we sat in this conference, and Les Asper looked down at me, and he said, and this captain there with those cadets, never in your lifetimes again will you see U.S. military forces deployed, because we learned our lessons in Vietnam. I thought, what am I doing? I mean, it's like, suppose you were a great surgeon, but people said, got to have surgeons, but keep them in reserve, because basically we live forever, and, you know, in the unlikely event someone has an accident, we might call on you, but mostly you'll go through your lifetime and never have to practice your skill. You say, well, okay, well, what's the point of this? Just marching in parades or what? So I looked at it. I did my studies at the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth and looked at all the interventions that had been done and tried to ask myself, would the United States ever intervene with military forces again? This was for my Master of Military Arts and Science. Turned out I got a second master's degree out of writing this paper. And I talked about and created this idea of coercive diplomacy that hadn't quite been articulated. I took off from some academics like Tom Schelling, who had talked about compellence as part of game theory, but they hadn't quite got the linkage right about how to use escalation dominance to squeeze the rationality out of a belligerent. Anyway, I put it aside. A few years later, I was interviewed for a position as General Alexander Haig's assistant executive officer when he was Supreme Allied Commander of Europe. And he said, if you come here, he said, I'll show you a crisis. This was 1978, but it was remarkably crisis-free. It was the Cold War. The only thing that happened in 1978 was we airlifted some troops into the Congo or something, or we lifted some Belgian troops into the Congo. It was actually pretty pacific, and I didn't get to practice coercive diplomacy or run and explain to General Haig how to do his job as SACUR. So, but I did look at this, and I want to try to explain it this way to you. As I see it, there are the three components dominating U.S. foreign policy: logic, politics, and bureaucratic politics. Now, I'm pulling this from the framework for analysis of a professor at Harvard named Graham Allison, whom some of you may know, and he wrote a very important book in the early 70s called The Essence of Decision, in which he looked at the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he identified these three elements as being critical in dominating decision, but I'm going a little beyond that. I'm saying these three elements are critical in the long course of U.S. foreign policy. Go back and look at how we emerged from World War II. We had the isolationists in the Republican Party, and both Harry Truman and Eisenhower fought the isolationist wing of the Republican Party, and we created an internationalist national security strategy. We built NATO, we created deterrence, and we even rejected the concept Eisenhower did of preventive war. He refused to engage in it. There was serious talk in 1953 that since we had the H-bomb and the Soviets only had the A-bomb, we had to use the H-bomb against the A-bomb before they got a Z-bomb, or logic of this effect, that somehow it was an alphabetized arms race. But Eisenhower knew better. National security played a big element in the 1960 presidential campaign, as John Kennedy warned of a missile gap. And it was the Democrats who took us into Vietnam. I know John Kennedy, had he lived, would have been much smarter than to have ever let us stay in Vietnam. A lot of people have said it, including Ted Sorensen, and I believe him. But that wasn't to be. And instead, we escalated in Vietnam, and suddenly it became Lyndon Johnson's war, and he couldn't run. And then it became Nixon's war. And the Democratic Party flip-flopped, and it became the Republicans who were the party of national security, not the Democrats, and it was the Republican war machine, and they were defeated. And Kissinger basically negotiated the surrender, or let's say the withdrawal of Vietnam from Vietnam, getting our pilots back, leaving a North Vietnamese army in place in Vietnam, which within a year or two, with Congress cutting off aid, ran in and ultimately, in a surprise move, completely crushed the South Vietnamese Army. And I was a captain at the Command and Staff College in the spring of 1975. The commandant called us in and said, gentlemen, ladies, there were a couple of ladies in the class, said, Saigon has fallen. The last American has been evacuated. And I'd had a tour. Most of the people there had more than one tour. We had Purple Hearts all over the place. We'd all shed our blood for this. We'd seen our friends and fellow officers and soldiers killed. And it was so ugly by 1974 when I got there that you couldn't say in class, well, here's what we learned in Vietnam. If you did that, people would go, it's like, come on, stop talking about Vietnam. And yet, suddenly the reality of defeat sunk in, and there were 1,200 men and women in that auditorium all sobbing with the failure in Saigon. The hardline Democrats left the Democratic Party. They moved over to the Republican Party, the Scoop Jackson Democrats. And by 1978, there was an open revolt against Jimmy Carter called the Committee on Present Danger. And it was a political strategy, and it was designed to force Carter out of office by focusing on the weakness in the strategic arms limitation talks, SALT II. And in fact, SALT II wasn't able to be ratified at that time because of the strength of the Republicans with this Democratic opposition. This is where guys like Wolfowitz and Pearl and the rest, who'd been Scoop Jackson Democrats, became Republicans en route to becoming neocons. Ronald Reagan brought us dawn in America. He invaded Grenada in 1983, and I remember writing the guidance to give the Army Chief of Staff with Colin Powell, and we wrote in the introduction, we said, whatever you do, don't ever commit U.S. troops again unless you've got enough troops to win. And Powell said, yeah, that's a good idea. Write that up, and I'll put that in and give it to General Wickham. And Wickham carried it into the tank in the discussions going into Grenada in 1983, and it later became the Weinberger Doctrine or the Powell Doctrine. And, I mean, we swarmed over Grenada. We took that 600-man Cuban engineer battalion, and we kicked their you-know-what. And there was a Captain John Abizade who was leading Alpha Company, 1st of the 75th Rangers, who actually, when he landed and jumped out of the helicopter, jumped out of the airplane at 500, 400 feet over the airfield there, and they charged up the hill against the dug-in Cuban positions. John and his guys got a Cuban bulldozer, turned it around, and used it as a tank to overwhelm the positions. And in only a little while, we had completely taken over the island with minimal losses, and the press said it wasn't a fair fight. That's the unfairness that I like. So that was the Powell Doctrine. Reagan took it a little step further. I mean, when Gaddafi got a little uppity, we did Operation Torrey Canyon, and we dropped a bomb, killed Gaddafi's daughter, or adopted daughter, I think, and hit his tent. And after that, he became a believer in air power, even though the French wouldn't allow us overflight permission. We launched out of the UK. It was dawn in America, and it led to then 1989 and so forth. We learned how to use force, despite Les Aspin. There was a certain logic that we carried through this period. At first, it was the logic of deterrence, and it carried us through the Cold War. And then, at the end of the Cold War, it was the logic of, well, what do you have to have these forces for? Well, because the United States is a big country with worldwide interests. Well, what interests? Well, defending allies, protecting access to oil, not taking oil, but it's the access to the oil. In other words, that no hostile power could sort of draw a ring around it and say, no tankers bound for America dare pass this line. Oh, no, you've got our Navy out there. We're going to secure our access to these critical resources and protect other vital American economic interests. And because we're a global power, the world's economic interests are our economic interests. So there was a logic to this. And the logic was, you just need some forces. Now, why did we name enemies? Well, because Congress asked us to name enemies. Because if you said, I'm looking for a capabilities-based defense, they'd say, what capabilities? They'd say, and you'd answer, well, you know, hostage rescue, to protect an ally, to go in against a drug lord, let's say, somewhere. Said, what hostage? Who would take hostages? Say, well, maybe, you know, terrorists in the Middle East. Well, what would you need for that? So you don't need all those divisions and those aircraft carriers. Well, you need, like, maybe, okay, you need, okay, let's say you need three aircraft carriers because one's in port, one's in route, and one's there. So, but you don't need all those divisions. Well, no, not for that, but what about protecting your allies? Which allies? Well, I mean, there's still a Korea, right? So, I mean, you got a North Korean threat. So before you knew it, you had rumbled back into defining the enemy. Because it was asked, otherwise you were going to get your budget cut. And then we ended up with two major regional conflicts. When it looked like Saddam might just not justify the forces we need, or Korea might be getting better, then we added Iran in it, just to sort of have a reserve conflict in case we needed one. But you knew you... I know. It sounds really childish, doesn't it? But the thing was, you knew you needed the forces, but you couldn't ask for them unless you could justify them, and you couldn't justify them unless you could find an enemy. Why would you think you would need the forces? Well, because, first of all, at the end of World War II, we cut the armed forces. The next thing we did is we recalled a bunch of people and sent them to Korea. They got their you-know-what kicked in Task Force Smith in 1950 in Korea, where they weren't trained and weren't capable and got overrun. We almost got forced off the Korean Peninsula. Then at the end of the Korean War, we cut forces again in the Army and went to the Big Bang Theory of trying to get the Air Force involved. And then we go into Vietnam and we didn't have enough forces and we still didn't know what we were doing. And then at the end of the Vietnam War, we cut forces again and threw out experienced captains and sergeants who'd been there. And lo and behold, Les Aspin was wrong, God rest his soul, and we had to go in and fight again in Grenada and Panama. And come on, how many times do we have to learn the same lesson in our lifetimes? The world's a big and dangerous place. The United States has worldwide interests, and you need worldwide military capabilities. So if you want to deter conflict and preserve order, somebody has to do it. And it's not going to be the French, despite their tous azimuth, azimuth defense. It's not going to be the Brits. They pulled back first, east of Aden, then east of Suez, and completely out of it. And I was the captain who wrote the paper in 1973 for the Army Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations, suggesting that with the British pullout from the Persian Gulf, can you imagine being this stupid in 1973 as to say, sometime it might be necessary to consider putting U.S. troops and forces into the Persian Gulf to secure access to American oil or to American required oil resources? I wrote that in 1973. The colonels around, I was a captain there, saying, young captain, you can't write things like this. This is inflammatory, it's not correct, and you're going to have your you-know-what hauled up in front of that Senator Fulbright, and he's going to grill you, and we're all going to get in trouble. And yet, look at where we are. So, I hear everything Mike has to say about realism, but there's a certain logic behind why the United States keeps a strong military. That's the logic. Now, the problem is there's also politics behind it. Just as the Committee on Present Danger formed up to force Carter out of office in the late 1970s and put Reagan in, so the Coalition for the Project for a New American Century formed up in the late 1990s to force President Clinton to sign on for an invasion of Iraq. This was the demand of the right wing of the Republican Party. And guys like Wolfowitz and Cheney in the Republican Party, if you want to get to where the money is, you got to go to the right. The money's on the right of the party, and if you have aspirations for leadership in that party, you toe that line. The Republican Party is much different than the Democratic Party, and I don't know if there's any Republicans here, and I hope I'm not hurting your feelings, but it's a very strong, ideologically based party that operates on certain strong principles, and those principles are debated for a while. Pretty soon they're locked down, and you either agree or you're dismissed as mostly irrelevant. So as much as I admire some of the moderate Republicans who are going to go along with the stimulus package, they're not in the centerpiece of the Republican Party today. Karl Rove still is. So it became a matter of political politics. And this politics is very, very powerful in America. And it's going to affect us. And then there's the bureaucracy of the bureaucratic politics that are involved. Look, we had these forces in the 1990s. What were we supposed to do with them? So we learned to do peacetime engagement. Why? Well, because we knew we needed to keep the forces, and you may as well, it's what Madeleine Albright says. Look, you got all these forces. What are you going to do with them? just sit by and let these people slaughter each other in the Balkans? Or, you know, why don't you go use them for clearing mines out of Angola or stopping the war in Bosnia? And so this was a difficult thing for the military to swallow, because we were involved in the Big Bang theory of the universe. You know, the bigger the war, that's what we're trained for. Real men don't do military operations other than war. As Charlie used to say, real men don't do mouvoir. So gradually we learned, we did it.
Who's Charlie?
Charlie Kashvili, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He saw the need for military operations other than war, but he had a very hard time getting the Pentagon to accept it. And my operations I was involved with, and I helped do the planning for the Haiti intervention in 94, the Bosnia intervention in 95, 96, and I was the commander in the peacekeeping in the Balkans and did the Kosovo operation. It was really hard to get the Pentagon to sign up for it, because what they really wanted to do was the invasion of Iraq. That's what they'd been told to do. That's what was driving their force planning. That's what was driving their training. And this was like a distraction. I mean, I was asking them to do something they just didn't want to do. So they competed against each other to be able to get the budget resources. I remember the first time I was taken in and showed the Army's use of the global positioning system in 1988. Very secret. There's something called GPS, these satellites in the sky, and we're going to actually use these for guidance. And, you know, it might help us hit targets and maneuver force. And I had to sign away my life and so forth. And they said, the most important thing about this is we can now go and say the Army is high technology also. Because, you know, high technology is cleaner, it's neater, and it's more deserving of funding. The Air Force gets 40 to 50% of the R&D money. The Army was getting 10 to 15% of the R&D money. The Air Force gets to spend $200 million on a fighter plane, but the Army can't spend $200 million to buy flak jackets to keep our truck drivers safe, or mount 50 caliber machine guns on the tops of the trucks, or put armor plate on them, or give them night vision goggles so they can see at night, or put a radio with them. No, that's wasted money. But we don't mind putting $200 to $300 million or $1 billion into a bomber. Now, that's really significant. It's high technology. You know, these. And it turns out, however, as we kept warning and we finally have proved, that if you want an effective military, you better protect the people that are in it. Because ultimately, the American people don't care how many tanks and Humvees and trucks and fighter planes get destroyed. What they care about is how many people are there and taken care of. So this was part of the bureaucratic politics that was part of the struggle. So there was a logic to it, there was a politics to it, and there was a bureaucratic gamesmanship to it. Now we're with Barack Obama. He's inheriting two wars, one in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. He's got a 58-seat majority in the Senate and a substantial majority in the House, but he's not veto-proof. He's vowed to work to the center and break the old spirit of partisanship. I guess the Republicans hadn't heard him yet, because they think the old spirit of partisanship is alive and well, and they smell blood in the water on the stimulus bill, and they're going after it completely like sharks. But the truth is, he's got to maintain control of the center, and he's got to operate a national security policy that doesn't leave him vulnerable to being criticized as being soft on, he used to say communism, soft on terrorists. Terrorists? Is that okay?
Terror.
And so he's appointed, you know, strong right-wing people for the national security side of the administration. And as Professor Mann observed, he's sort of, you know, hedging his 16-month-and-out pledge on Iraq and so forth. Why? Because this is smart from the logical side. It's smart on the political side. It's the right way for him to get to deal with the major issues he wants. He's got to march down the road of maintaining control of the middle. He's going to broaden the struggle against terrorists. He's going to do more criminalizing them, I hope. I mean, I hope that was the logic of of having the military commission shut down on that prosecution. Not that the guy shouldn't be prosecuted, but do it in a way that we can be proud of American justice rather than setting up something that is criticized and closed in the eyes of the world. Because if you want to defeat terrorists, you have to win the battle of ideas first. You can't win it by killing people, although you may have to do that. It's about cutting off their recruiting base and delegitimating the terrorist organization. He's going to do more working with allies. He's going to do more pushing on economic development. But he can't forget the nature of the news cycle. The nature of the news cycle is you need two sides. It doesn't matter whether there's any logic behind the other side. And to my mind, in the stimulus bill, there's very little logic behind the tax cutting. Very little logic. We tried it in May, and what it produced was more than 50% of the tax cut stimulus being saved. So it gave no stimulus at all. And I haven't talked to anybody, maybe some of you in this room are different, but if you got a $10,000 windfall, I don't think you'd go out and put a down payment on a Prius. I think you'd probably say, you know, I just don't know what's happening. I'm a little uncertain. I think I'll leave this in my bank account. Or, you know, a lot of people would probably pay down their credit card balances. And yet, this is an argument, a fight to the finish right now on the stimulus package, and that's what his priority is, and he knows the news cycle. So I'm one of the guys who helped create the phrase full-spectrum dominance, Michael. And the point of it is to not only be able to dominate high-intensity warfare, but to win a battle in a city. The United States Armed Forces are strong today, and President Barack Obama is not going to be able to bring change to the United States by making us weak, by pulling out precipitously from Iraq, or by sacrificing what we're doing in Afghanistan. I agree with all the concerns you faced. I understand the limitations of the logic of war better than you could imagine. There's a way to get there, but that way is patient and slow and operating from the center. I wish it weren't so. I wish it were possible to simply snap our fingers and say, there's a new sheriff in town. Wait, somebody said that already, and it didn't work. So let's don't think that there's any magic solutions to this. We are where we are. We're going to work with what we've got, and I believe this president is going to help us bring hope, change, and reduce America's propensity for conflict. Let's give him the chance to do so. Thank you. Thank you.